Okay, this week's parsha is Parshat Balak. So we start off with a confederation which is being formed, and the identity of the various people is important, and in the past that's part of what we focused on, is who exactly are these people, where they came from, who the tribes are. I want to start reading, and then we'll divert. Vayar Balak ben Zippor et kol asher asa Yisrael le'emori. So one thing which is interesting is we're not told who he is, just the name. It's a little strange that only later on we're going to be told, oh, he happened to be the king at that point. So that's a little strange, and that's why it's brought some to the conclusion that he was not originally king, that he actually utilized this, this was an agenda which catapulted him to the position of leadership. Vayar Balak ben Zippor et kol asher asa Yisrael le'emori. It saw what the Jews had done to the Emori, so, or Israel did to the Emori, so maybe we need to go backwards a little bit to know, okay, what is it that they did to the Emori, and why was this good or why was this bad? So for the moment, turn to source 16. And that takes us back all the way to Perikuf Aleph, which is really not all that long ago, considering that we're starting in Perikuf Bet, which means it's the end of last week's Parsha. Now, those of you who didn't notice this, or this was not significant to you, something really important happened last week. And I'm not only speaking about the whole idea of the Meimariva and what happened, and the deaths of Miriam and of Aaron and Moshe's death sentence. Something else happened last week. And that was something which we can argue had been promised to Avraham a very, very long time ago. Because if you go back and you look at the Brit Bein HaBetarim, one of the things that it says is, I'm going to give you this land, but there was a catch. So I don't know if you all remember the catch. The catch was, well, not yet, because this, the Avon of the Emori was not complete yet. So what exactly does that mean, the Avona Emori? So this verse is actually a really important verse. I think it was last year, 2 years ago, I'm trying to remember. I had co-authored this book with Senator Joe Lieberman, and one of the aspects of the book was about law. So one of the things that I try to show in one of the chapters that I wrote was that law goes all the way back. Because you would think that law starts with at Sinai. And prior to Sinai, by the Avot, there's really not law. So, but I pointed out that verse. That verse tells us something, that the Emori are here in the land until they no longer deserve to be in the land. The Avon Emori. Avon Emori means that there's laws, there's rules. You can get expelled. You can only get expelled if there's reasons for expulsion. And, you know, that shouldn't come as such a big surprise, because you have a city like Stone. Stone gets destroyed. Why? Because they did bad things. That means that there's rules. That means even prior to Matan Torah, there are rules. And we speak of them sometimes as the mitzvot b'nei Noach. Okay, there are rules. There's moral rules. If you want to go on a more spiritual level, you can say that the land of Israel is a holy land. And by the way, God says this. And then you can say that it's a land which will vomit out those who are not deserving to be here. And by the way, the Torah says that. And therefore, it's just a question of timing. How much bad do you need to do in order to be sent out? So over here, lo shalema avon emori adhina, because the iniquity of the emori is not complete, which means there's also God will give a second chance and a third chance and so on. So that's also interesting. So in last week's parsha, what happens? Well, look at source 16. V'yikach Yisrael et kol ha'arim ha'eleh, Vayeshiv Yisrael b'kol arei ha'emori. They settled in the land of Emori. Now, again, this is one of these things that happened last week, and we go through and so on, and we'll pay the water. Over here, the Emori is not the same thing as some of the other people who, shall we say, are part of the larger Avraham family. The people to large, and if you really want to go all the way back to have a Bereshit perspective on this, an early Bereshit perspective, it's essentially going to be the children, if you take the three children of Noach, they are Shem, Ham, and Yafet. So all the people who are going to be chased out of the land of Israel are going to be the descendants of Ham. All the people who are allowed to stay in the area will be the descendants of Shem. So that's really, you know, that's the Bereshit way of reading through Bamidbar to understand what exactly is happening. So the Emori are people who come from Ham. in Bereshit, when Avram was promised the land, it's till they no longer deserve it. And they will at some point no longer deserve it. They will be chased out, which then I think gives us some kind of background. But there was a little bit more intrigue over here, which is actually the background to our story. And without reading this, you can't understand it. And how do I know that this is the background? Let's read source one, the first verse again. Don't leave 16. We're going to stay there. Vayar Balak ben Zippor kol asher asa Yisrael le'emori. He saw what the Israel did to the Emori. So that means this is the issue. So what exactly did they do that was so bad to the Emori? Continue in 16, Pasuk Kavav. Ki cheshbon ir sichon melech Emorihi. Because they took cheshbon, that was the end of Pasuk Kavav. V'hun lucham b'melech Moav harishon. Kol ad Arnon. So apparently, things in the Middle East never change. And that is that we have squabbles, and we have wars, and we have fighting. And somebody took a piece of land that at some point belonged to somebody else. And how far back do you figure out whose land is it, whose ancestral land it may have been? But over here, the intrigue is very, very simple. Israel captures the land of the Emori, which had previously belonged to Moab. So now Israel, by the way, that's when people get upset. When Israel is sitting in the land, this may sound political to some of you, so I'll be a little careful. But when Israel is sitting in the land which once belonged to Moab, at that point Moab says, okay, we need to bring all the countries together and we need to go to war against them. You don't need to read the newspapers, but you could just go back and read over here. Now, there's something else which is incredibly important that today what we're going to do is there's going to be a first thought about these things. I'm going to give you direction that you can think about as you want to, if you choose to continue with it. But I want to read a little bit more back over here, because now you at least know the background. V'yiket kol artzo, and the Emori had taken all the land of this first, Melech Moav HaRishon. Now we're going back. I don't know how far back we're going, but we're going back. You realize how funny this is. I'm sorry for saying funny. This could be a story which goes back 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 400 years. You don't know reading this how far back this story may be and how far back this memory is. Oh, they took our land now. Now we're in trouble. But v'kachet kol artzo miyado ad Arnon, al kein yomru hamoshlim. And therefore the motion, this is what they sing. This is the song. This is like the top 10, which is on the, I don't know if they had FM then, probably only AM in those days. So this is what they used to go about and say the Moshlim. Bo cheshbon, tibonev yiknen ir sichon. Ki esh yatsa mi cheshbon, lahava mi kiryat sichon, achla or moav ba'alei bamot Arnon. And they ate a place or swallowed a place called Or, Moav Ba'alei Bamot. Now the question is, this is source 16 still, Pasuk Kafchet, what does Moav Ba'alei Bamot Arnon mean? If you look in Targum Onkelos, it will tell you that this is a place where they worship some kind of an Avodah Zarah. Komareha de Palchin de Beit Dachla Ramta. This is a place where they worship some kind of a cult, right? Oy locha Moav, avadata am Kamosh. Woe unto Moav, you've lost the people of Kamosh. If you look in the Targum Onkelos over here, he will tell you it's the Palchan le Kamosh, that Kamosh is actually an idolatry. Now the truth is, if you knew Tanakh really well, you would know that already. If you don't know Tanakh really well, then you'll have to trust me on this. And it's this background of knowing the various gods is what really interests me today. But it's interesting that when they would sing the dirge about the loss of the city or the capture of the city, depending which side is singing, if it's a dirge or it's this song of victory, what we're told over here is that Moab is lost. But we're told also about Moab, and it makes a connection with two different gods. Now, Kamosh is actually the god which is much more connected with Moab, just in case you didn't know this. But it also mentions this idea of Baal, or Baalei Bamot are known. So also Baal, and anybody who knows about Baal, Baal gets around. And essentially, Moab is lost, and what is the song saying? its gods could not help. Its gods proved helpless, and therefore Moav got lost. On the other hand, the Amori are victorious, but what's the problem with our story when we start today? When we start today, we realize that now Israel has come, well, that's the end of last week's parsha, and now has been victorious against Ammon. Now, what I want you to try to understand, and this is going to be difficult for us, it's not just a question of politics, and it's not just a question of military victory. It's also a question of theology in terms of various gods being proven to at least having a bad day, or maybe more than that. But it's this whole issue of the gods which are involved in this, which is really the background of this story, because what we're talking about in this week's parsha is going to be about various nations who are going to come against Israel, and all of these nations are polytheists. All of these nations believe in a host of different gods, and they're coming and attacking the Jews not just in terms of a military sense. When I say not just, actually, that never really happens, because they're scared of us when it comes to a military sense, which is really quite interesting. But rather, that what they're trying to do is to somehow manipulate whatever spiritual forces they can get their hands on in order to be victorious. So my point is that maybe to understand that, we need to have a little bit of a better understanding of what they believed in terms of these spiritual powers that were at their disposal. Now, the one who actually seemed to me to be the most interested in this whole issue turns out to be the Netziv. The Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva from Volozhin, who, unlike other yeshivot, would give a morning parsha shir, and that eventually became his book. His commentary to the Chumash was put together, and he spends a lot of time on this, which means he keeps coming back again and again. If you want one quick insight, look at source 17, and then we'll be able to go backwards and see where we get today. Vatikrena la'am lizivchei Elohim. So this is after the girls come down and they encourage them to worship their gods. Kol apano titra'u ba'et achlam zivchei Elohim. As they were eating, they would then tell them, amnam lo haya Elohim avodah zarah pa'or ki'im kamush. But the girls from Moav, they didn't worship pa'or, rather they worshipped kamush. Now, just in case you're reading that, if you would have read that line by yourself, you would have said, where did all that come from? So that's what I wanted you to see, is that when they would sing about Moav having lost, oh, people who believe in Kamush didn't have a good day. Nonetheless, now when they're encouraging the Jews to serve their gods, actually what he's going to be doing at the end there when the girls come down, you're going to now realize that it's much more complicated than you would have thought. Because somehow there's something Baal, there's Baal Pa'or, which may be the same, and there's also the whole sexual sins which are taking place, but now he just threw Kamush into all of this. Why would he throw Kamush in? Because you're talking about Benot Moav. And Benot Moav, theoretically at least, would be worshipping Kamush. Although, I will point out, there's one more thing which is interesting about Benot Moav. No, absolutely. There's no exclusivity when it comes to these things. They were not monogamous in their relationships with their gods. Back in source 16, pasuk kaftet, oylecho moav vadata am kamush natan banav pleitim, and your sons became refugees. Uvnotam bishivit lemelech emori sichon, and your daughters became captured by this king of Sichon, of the Amori, which means the daughters are captured, which itself has all kinds of implications. And let's not forget something else. Daughters of Moav is just an interesting phrase, and why is that? Well, first of all, it's the end of this week's parsha. Secondly, the daughters of Moav, okay, so now we see there's a little bit of background where the daughters may have been used. What happens afterwards? Were those daughters ever liberated? What happened to these girls? But the reason why it's interesting is, where does Moav even come from? Moav comes from the daughters of Lot, which means that there is this constant cloud of sexual impropriety which hangs about when it comes to this family of Moav, especially to the daughters, and therefore I'm just pointing out that all of this is sitting here in the background. So now we can start the parsha, now that we have a little bit of insight. V'yar Balak ben Zippor et kol asher asa Yisrael Amori. Balak, he saw everything which had happened and that Israel now had done to the Amori. V'yagar Moav bnei Am Ma'od ki Ravhu. And what we have over here is fear because there were so many. V'yakatz Moav bnei Israel, and there was, and they detested them. So we have all of our wonderful anti-Semitic elements that you want all here. V'yom Moav el ziknei Midyan. Now, when you see the word Zikne Minyad, so it's very easy to translate, right? The elders. But when you see the word Zikne, Zikne or Zaken or Zikina could mean one of two things, certainly in biblical passages. And, of course, you know that the way that I would decide what the meaning is would be by looking into the Targum and saying how it can translate. But there's two possibilities it can translate it. If you look in Vayikra, Perek Yud Tet, you don't have it in front of you, but if you look there, and it says, "Bnei Seva Takum," right? You should stand up in front of a Seva. And then it continues in the same Pasuk and talks about giving honor to somebody who is elderly, right? V'hadar Pnei Zaken. So you have Seva and you have Zaken, so it could just be poetic, but are those the same words? Let me go back a bit because you don't know what I'm saying yet. Anybody here, a grandparent, Do you let your grandchildren refer to you as Saba or Safta?
Bubby.
Good. Leave the Bubby out. Saba or Safta, what does the word Saba or Safta mean? So it's the Aramaic translation of Zaken, which means it means an old person. It means an old person. That's what the word means. Okay? What? It's going to stop. The translation of Zaken is sab, the translation, right? So it just means somebody who's old. That's what the word means. On the other hand, if we recall back, this is the advantage of doing Shtayim Mikra Ve'echad Targum year after year after year, so I actually remember some of these. If you look back by Yosef, where Yosef was referred to as a ben zikunim, so what was the translation then? So is he a son of an elderly man? He's a son, therefore it would be ben sab, or something like that, bar sab, but it's not the way that the Targum translates it. He translates it instead as Chakim, somebody who's wise, a Chacham, which means that he was a Ben Zikunim, he was a very wise young man, which now leads me to the two possible interpretations of the word Zaken. A Zaken could mean an elder chronologically, or a Zaken can mean an elder in terms of wisdom. Whenever the Targum wants to tell us that it means somebody who's wise, it will translate Zaken as Chacham, Chakim. Whenever it wants to tell us that it's a chronological statement, it will translate it as Sab. So those of you who will keep letting yourselves be called as Saba or Safta, yes, I figured this out when I became a grandfather, and I said, I wonder what the word Saba comes from. I wonder who made this up. And again, very often modern Hebrew words actually have their source in Aramaic. So I guess it was good because a lot of us would not want to be called old person, right? That's why Bubby rules. Would not want to be called. But for a lot of people, the association with Bubby is much older in their minds. Okay. So we'll just take you down from that Bubby claim here. But, okay. So if you now think about it, this term here, Vayoma Moav El Ziknei Midyan. So what I'm intrigued with is how would we translate that? Is he speaking to the wise men, right? Is this the intellectuals? Is these the people that you go to for advice? Or is he speaking to the old people? So how did you understand the pasuk? When if you were to translate this word, if you're unculus, channel your inner unculus, and do you translate this as a wise, does he go to the wise people, or is he going to the elderly people?
Wise.
Excellent. He translates it as elderly. So I know if I just would have said it by itself, that would have been completely uninteresting. Does anybody now realize why it is interesting and what it actually means? Well, it's interesting because it was counterintuitive. Because you would think if you're about to get ready for some kind of, be it political, military, theological fight, that you want to get the smartest brains involved in this before you proceed. But it's not what he does. Instead, he goes, you got the right answer now? You have the right answer? Okay, so instead, what does he do? Instead, he goes to the oldest people, the oldest memories, because what's he interested in? It's all about history. It's all about history. It's all about what was. Which means when I go back and I said that, no, there's a history, there's a background over here, and that is that the Emori captured the cities of Moab, he's going back to the people that still remember that, or the people at least heard that, or maybe the people, again, I don't know how long it is. It's the oral histories. He's not interested in people coming, but I hope you really appreciate this, why there is a wonderful manipulation taking place over here. He's not approaching the people who are necessarily going to be the best political or military or theological advisors to tell us present, moving towards future. He's interested in creating a narrative and going to the people who live in the past in order to get people all worked up about what is taking place over here. And essentially, if you want to turn this as anti-Semitic as you can, look at those Jews, they've taken our land. Of course, you haven't had the land for a very long time, but that's why you need people with the memory. Yeah, that used to be our land. That was my grandmother's house. That was my great, right? This is all our land. Now, the truth is we had nothing to do with them. We had nothing to do with Moab in all of this. This was against the Emori. And again, if you want to go backwards, you want to have a memory, God promised this land to Avram a really long time ago. Now, that became a little bit more interesting. When God says you can have the land of the Emorites, does that include the lands that they captured from the Moabites? So that's where, I'm saying that's where things got a little more interesting, but that's the whole background here. So let's continue. V'yom Moab el Ziknei Binyan. And what's interesting over here, it's Moab to Ziknei Midian. Not just Ziknei Moab, we'll see. And it talks about, and now these people are coming and they're going to go through the land and so on. Atayi lachachu akahalat kol sivivotenu kilachach hashor et yerek hasadeh ubalak ben Tzippor melech l'Moab be'etahi. And Balak, the son of Tzippor, he was the king of Moab, and that's why there is a tradition he became king at that point. That he was able to scare people into eventually appointing him king because he's the one who understands the problem. He's the one who's able to put the problem in historical terms. And again, I'm adding that phrase, historical terms. V'yishlach malachim el Bilam ben Ba'or Pitora, asher al nahar eretz b'nei Amo, l'krolo, lemor, hinei am yotzei Mitzrayim, hinei kisa et ein haaretz, hu yoshev mimuli. V'tal lachana arali et ha'am hazeh. So again, the choice of going to Bil'am is quite interesting, and you're going to come and ask them to curse them, which is really interesting. And perhaps I'll be able to fight against him and chase them away. And again, the Targum here had two possibilities of translating this as the wise people of Moab and the wise people of Midian, and it's not how he translates it. He translates it as the elderly. He sends the elderly on this mission to go and say, and I'll say it again, what the Targum is doing over here is building a case, and the case, again, this is just one very sharp point. It's all about historical knowledge, historical perspective, and let's go in the past. Let's figure out how we got here. Not necessarily the wisest people who can move forward, because sometimes when you're stuck in the past, it actually gets you into a great deal of trouble. Sometimes you need to look at a problem in a new way and to be able to analyze it in a new way. And only using old definitions and old terms is something which could get you into trouble. So what are we skipping over? We're skipping over why the choice of Bilam. The whole Bilam veneer is a veneer of being an Avraham wannabe, right? And that of course, is interesting. And as I said, these are things we've spoken about in the past. The group of people over here, who are they? They're Moab and they're Midian. Moab and Midian, of course, have a common denominator, and that common denominator is Avraham. Moab is the child of Lot and his daughter, which Lot, of course, is the nephew of Avraham. On the other hand, Midian is the son of Avraham through his later concubine, one of the Bnei Keturah. So you over here have two people who are brought up in the Avraham tent, namely Midian and Moab, or at least with an Avraham memory, as it were, which is really interesting because you want to talk about having a memory. Shouldn't your memory go back to Avraham's tent? Shouldn't that be the thing that was passed on from generation to generation? So you have over here people who have a common denominator, and then you read about Bilam, who essentially comes from Avram's hometown, and his business card must say, I am the Avraham of this generation, because look what it says. We know that whoever you bless is blessed, whoever you curse is cursed. And wasn't that a blessing that God had actually given to Avraham? Which means we have an Avraham wannabe, and we have two Avraham, shall we say, larger family members over here. And that's the whole common denominator of this, is that they're trying to channel in, there's some kind of Avraham powers. Of course, the irony is, you're going to take Avraham's powers in order to curse Avraham's real children, and descendants, and certainly spiritual descendants. How well do you think that's going to work out? So that's essentially the background of the whole story. So we're fast-forwarding. One of the other things that when you read through the Parsha that you should pay attention through, and this is all the way through the Parsha, and to the point that if you're going to be serious about it, I know you won't be. This is like just part of the fantasy here. But if you're going to be serious about it, what you really need to do is make a chart. And the chart will have every time the name of God is used, Yudkei Vavkei, and every time the name of God is used in terms of Elohim, because there's a lot of back and forth switch going on over here, presentation of one, reality of the other, and essentially Midat HaRachamim, Yudkei Vavkei, God's real essence, versus Midat HaDin, Elohim being used. And I'm saying that's all there, even in the very beginning, in terms of the conversations that are taking place between Bilam and the people that came. But we're skipping all that. And what we want to get to is when he attempts to go and do what his job was, and that is to curse and therefore destroy the people. Of course, what we're wondering about in all this is, where does his power come from? Does he really have such power? Can he really manipulate God? Can God be manipulated? What difference does a curse make? I know it's painful when people say some things to us which are hurtful, but what power does that have other than our own egos having been damaged and feeling bad about what they said to us? Just because somebody said something that has any kind of power? Just because Bilam says something that's going to cause any kind of reality? All of that is really quite mysterious, even though there is this persistent rumor in the background in Chazal, that, you know, lo kam b'Yisrael kemosha, but for the non-Jews, there was a guy like Bilam, and Bilam was the real deal, and he had some kind of a power, and that, of course, intrigues us. So let's start in source number 2. V'yelech Bilam im Balak, and we realize that that was not simple itself, how we got to that point that he went, but he ends up going. V'yavo kiryat chutzot. Now, I have no idea what kiryat chutzot means. I looked in around a dozen different translations of the Chumash last night, Jewish, Christian, someplace in the middle, and all of them translated as Kiryat Chutzot. they all just write Kiryat Chutzot. Oh, very good. That's very good. That's how Aryeh Kaplan translates it in his Living Torah. Yes. But Rashi also seems to go in that direction. Rashi seems to go in that direction as well. But I said that's interpretation, but translations just seem to leave it with its name. V'yizbach Balak Bakar. So now, who's doing the slaughter? Who's doing the offerings here? Who's the Kohen, if you will? It's Balak. It's not Bilam. It's Balak. V'yizbach Balak Bakar. Now, again, Vitzon. Now, as he's doing this, what does he have in mind? Is he serving God? And I say God now with a capital G. You could even put a dash in the middle if you must. Or is he serving something else? So, v'yizbach Balak bakar v'tzon, v'yishlach le'bil'am v'lesarim asher ito. So he's a great host. He does his holy, now the only word that you want to add in, is this cultic? Is this his cultic barbecue that he's doing over here? Is this, who is he serving when he's doing this? To me, that's actually really intriguing, especially if this is going to work and we're going to try to get God to curse the Jews. You know, what kind of powers are you trying to utilize as you're doing this? Or are you serving God directly? Which means I'm saying this question that I'm bringing up in terms of theology / idolatry, to me is, I think, really the intriguing question. But let's continue a little bit more. V'yihi b'boker, and then in the morning, v'yikach Balak et Bilam, Vayalehu bamot Baal. Now, does those words bamot Baal do anything for you? doesn't do much for us, actually. It's, yeah, that means that he's utilizing idolatry in this Vayar Misham Kitzei Ha'am. That means he goes to this, apparently, for whatever is going to happen to work. And you all know that when it comes to, at least my knowledge of all of this, I'm limited. I don't know all that much about how all of these things work. The second thing I don't know about is the exact geographical or topological setup, because he's going to a place that he can see. So I don't know exactly where the Jews are sitting. I don't know what your choices are in terms of climbing mountains and looking at them. So he obviously goes up to a high place, but it really is quite interesting that it says, Vayleu Bamot Baal, which means he could have chosen, I assume he could have chosen different places, but to specifically choose a place which is connected to Bamot Baal, altars of Baal, and it's from there, go take a look. I can't disassociate whatever's taking place here from some kind of cultic, idolatrous experience. And one more thing. So to say that Bilam is going to go and he's going to be talking to God and God is going to be talking to him and he's going to curse the Jews and so on, I said before that there was a lack of exclusivity when it came to the idolaters, and there was probably far more sort of moving from one god to another god and taking in a god and, you know, taking in a third god or a fourth god, and these things were fluid. The fluidity over here is quite surprising. I'm saying again, if we were dealing with a monotheist. But if you're not dealing with a monotheist, then what's the problem? And nobody ever accused Balak of being a monotheist. No, but the reason is because I don't want to pigeonhole any of them. And see, there's a couple things which are interesting here. One is what the text says, and two is Tanakh's understanding of things. Three is things seen from outside, and four is how Chazal see it. Now, Chazal may be guilty, and I want to be a little careful about this. Chazal may be guilty sometimes when it speaks about idolatry of doing something which is an ethic within Chazal, and we don't always realize that, and that is that they believe you can make fun of idolatry. So they believe it. I mean, they say it. You're allowed to make fun of idolatry. So sometimes when they're reporting about idolatrous behavior, we don't know if they are reporting quote-unquote honestly or if what they're doing is they're creating a caricature. Because within, again, think about it. What is Tanakh if not a book which is at war with idolatry? I mean, that's basically, if you're going to write the book review, that's what the book is about. And if you don't want to tell me it's the primary message of the book, then it's the subtext of the book. You can tell me, no, the book is the book about the people of Israel and the war that went on between monotheism and polytheism. That's what the book is about. So by the time you get to Chazal, and it's going to be saying certain things, for example, when we get to Pa'or, the Gemara is going to tell us the way they worship Pa'or was to defecate in front of Pa'or. As far as I know, there is no information in the ancient Near East that supports that position of Chazal. Now I have to then ask myself, is Chazal reporting something because they have a better memory or tradition? Or is this an example where Chazal feel that they have the right or the responsibility to turn these things into caricatures, and therefore they're taking an extreme statement about it? Now, of course, the problem is that throughout generations you're going to have rabbinical students who are going to learn their comparative religion from reading a passage of Gemara, so sometimes that's not the best way to learn comparative religion. Sometimes you have to realize where the source is coming from. But again, I'm not saying it's that misinformation, quite the opposite. I'm saying it's deliberately trying to make fun of what they're dealing with. And that does happen, so therefore we need to be a little bit careful. The point of taking the Ksamim correct, I some reason skipped over that. That was the very end of source number one. When I said, I stopped in the middle, Vayechu Ziknei Moav, Ziknei Midyan, Uksamim Biadam. Absolutely. And they're going with their own types of magic and so on. Incidentally, what may be interesting about that, just in terms of Midyan, it says that when Avraham sent away the children, the concubines, it says he sent them to the east and he gave them matanot. He sent them all away, gave them matanot. There is a Gemara, and if I'm not mistaken, Rashi quotes it in his commentary, that he gave them all, and it is a very strange comment, he gave them all kinds of strange spiritual or alien spiritual presence. The ksamim, which are mentioned here, may have been from Avraham's collection prior to becoming a monotheist. And maybe I'm overstating it, but I'm saying that that's actually what Rashi, citing the Gemara, seems to say. Moving back to source number two, and realizing that the place that he takes them is Bamot Baal, so I can't get away from that. Because if you're going to tell me, no, that just happened to be in the name of the mountain that was there, that doesn't work. I see from some of your faces that doesn't work for you either. That, no, they're trying apparently to channel whatever power they imagine belongs to these particular nations and their gods, and they're trying to use that in their war against the Jews, which is really interesting, because by the time we get to the end of the story, they again use other forms as well. It's not, so don't mistake this. They said, okay, let's contract Bilam, and he's going to attack them from a monotheist perspective. That doesn't happen here. So Vayar Misham Ketze Ha'am, and he saw some of the people there, and what the Ketze Ha'am means is interesting, because there's one interpretation here. Let's see if I can quickly remember. Look at 14, the Kli Yakar. Vayalehu bamot ba'al, vayar misham k'tzei ha'am, ze chipus rishon asher hitzitz bishorash shel ha'uma. V'yechapes v'imtze ki mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoteinu, and so on and so forth. So that's just great in terms of our general theme of going to the elders. Let's go and look historically where these people came from, which is actually quite interesting, because I could have said the common denominator and the history over here goes back to Avraham, but you see what the argument then, which again I think is a brilliant insight of the Kli Yakar, whether it's pshat in what Ketze Ha'am means, and it's debated what the word Ketze means in this, is that they saw the whole nation, you know, all the way to the border, or they saw a little part of the nation. But he's saying that Ketze Ha'am means really the origins of this nation, where it really all began from. And it's saying, but instead of saying it began from Avraham, again, who is our monotheist, instead it's saying that where did it begin from? It began from Terach, and Terach was this idolater. And therefore, these people also are subject to whatever idolatry exists. But that's where, again, going back in history, that's where it came from. Of course, all of us can say, well, that just may have been a mistake. So realize that, again, what happens right here is not necessarily an aberration, but I want to continue back in source number two. It starts a new chapter for those of you who are students of the archbishop. As far as we're concerned, it's just still the same paragraph. V'yom ha'bilom ha'balak b'neili b'zeh shiva mizbachot. Build me here 7 altars. But where are they? They're by this Bamot Baal. And that's where they're building these altars. V'chein li b'zeh shiva parim u'shiva ilim. V'yas Balak asher diber Bilam. So he does this. V'yal Balak u'bilam par v'ayil b'mizbeach. And they bring their offerings. V'yomer Bilam l'Balak yitzev alotecha. V'elcha ulai yikare Hashem. Okay, here it's Yudke Vavke. And maybe God is going to come and appear to me l'krati. U'devar ma'yir eni v'gadat elecha v'yelech shefi. V'yikar Elokim. Again, he's looking for Yudke Vavke and V'yikar. Those of you who remember Rashi, and it's over here, it's also the very beginning of Vayikra. V'yikar is a very cold way of speaking. Not a warm, you know, how you doing, Bilam? What's new? It's a very cold way of speaking. And he's looking for this Yudke Vavke, this warmth, and so on. Instead, V'yikar Elokim El Bilam. I can understand why God's upset. Did you really just now build a Mizbeach by this Baal? You know, like what are you thinking? What is the matter with you? And then he's calling God, okay, now will you curse my people? Like, that's insanity. I mean, theological or insanity. Basically saying, yeah, you know, I did my part. I built the Mizbeach. I brought the offerings. You know, let's go. And then he tells them what to say, and we all know that God said all wonderful things about the Jews. Essentially, go back to the idolater and tell him that, no, that's... Not, again, I'm not going to tell you, I don't even know how to say this in English, what the Havamina is, right? Why in the world did you think that this was going to work? So you notice what I'm doing is, again, the background of everything I'm saying is the pagan beliefs and the pagan practices. But to see that it's actually part of the narrative over here means that you really can't escape it unless you choose to ignore it. Well, there is only one God, but they're building, well, apparently, see, and that's what's really interesting, because it never actually said that. It never actually, I know that, it never actually says in the text who the offerings were directed towards. We have location, and then we have to say, look, we brought the offerings, but who are you doing? Are you hedging your bets here? What is taking place here? I'm just saying it's far more interesting than when you just read this the first time. The Targum Yonatan, really, we're going to terribly run out of time today, but the Targum Yonatan, in source number 3, he says, oh, they built this thing. He is in Perek Kaf Bet. Mem Aleph, what was the pasuk there? V'kach balamit b'la, right? V'yaleu bamot ba'al. V'hava b'idonit safra. Sorry, that's the next. V'hi b'boker v'yikach So he translates this as Dachlata de Pa'or, Baal Pa'or. He brought Dachlata. What's a Dachlil? A scarecrow, but it's actually a false god. It's an imitation god. That's a Dachlil in Aramaic. And some reason somebody decided that would be a great word for a scarecrow, which you could just begin to think about how funny that use of scarecrow. Dachlil, right? Dachlata de Pa'or. So the Hebrew over here was Baal, so he brought this orphan to us. But it also says that he saw, at the edge, he saw the tribe of Dan. Read source 4, which will be the Hebrew of that. V'yilel Ramah shel hayirah shel Pa'or, where it was the god of Pa'or. V'yar misha machane Dan she'mahalachim b'kzei am shelu mitachat anei hakavod. So they were kicked out from the Anei HaKavod. That was the katzeh. They saw the group of Jews who were kicked out. Why would Dan have been kicked out? So look at 6 first, and then we'll go back to 5. The lama sher itzal dan lefish shabishavet dan he apesel micha, v'lo haya apesel imo mamash, elo she'ala b'machshavato la'asoto misha sheyotzu mimitzrayim u'machshavet avazar kima'aseh. So let me try to explain. The tribe of Dan were kicked out. Why? Because they were worshiping this idolatry of micha. The only problem is, the Midrash admits, is that they really didn't have the idol of Micha yet. It will appear later on in history. But they were thinking about it. And when it comes to idolatry, idolatrous thoughts are as bad as the action itself. Just hold on to that. I'll see if I can come back to it. Look at source number 5. But in the book of Shoftim, again, this goes back to our knowledge of Tanakh. V'yikru'u shem ha'ir Dan b'shem Dan avihim, asher yulad l'Yisrael. The place is called Dan. V'yekimu lahem b'nei Dan et ha-pesel. V'yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, hu v'nav yu kohanim. Now, if you looked at the larger context here, they were Levi'im. In fact, the Midrashim tell us a very bad thing about these people. It claims it's not really ben Menashe, that his name was really Moshe. And this is Gershom ben Moshe. This is Moshe's grandson. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Moshe. So you ever wonder, so whatever happened to Moshe's family? This is the most horrific report. This is the most horrific report, that there's a little bit of a cover-up because they changed it from Moshe to Menashe to cover up. But this is Gershom ben Moshe. His grandson was a Levi, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Moshe, and he becomes this idolatrous priest in this place. Uvanava yukonim l'shevet hadani ad hayom galut ha'aretz v'yasimu lahem et pesel micha asher asa kol yimayot beit Elohim b'shilo. So therefore, while there was this whole Mishkan and Shiloh, they set up their own place. And this is, again, if this tradition is true, it would be a very sad story of people who, going back to history, well, my grandfather, my great-grandfather was, but they're not, and therefore they decide to take a position as the Kohen in this idolatrous cult. So what's interesting over there is it's the tribe of Dan. So over here you have, what the Targum did is that they saw the very edge. Dan was at the very edge, but they say, why would Dan have been kicked out? Dan was kicked out because of Pesel Micha. But what did the Midrash admit? Pesel Micha didn't exist yet, but they were already thinking about it. Is that the idolatrous thoughts already had planted their seeds within, and already planted their seeds within the people, and that's going to be part of this problem, which is also actually really interesting then. Who does Bilam think he has the ability to curse? The Jews, who are really not that good. Again, go back to the Kli Yakar, it goes all the way back to Terach. Oh, they're idolatrous. We can go after them. On the other hand, it goes after those who were kicked outside of the camp because they're going to end up worshiping Pesel Micha, so therefore they're also susceptible to this attack right now. But again, it's interesting, where all this is coming from. Continuing in the narrative in source number 7, let's try it again. V'yom Balak el Bilam, you're like, what do you do? What do you do? You know, I want you to curse them and you bless them. Right? And we're skipping. Pasuk Yud Gimel. V'yom elav Balak l'chuna iti el makom acher. He goes, let's try a different place. And this is what convinces me that it wasn't an accident they went to that place for the first time. Why don't we go to a different place? Which means the place over here is of significance. Asher tir'enu misham efes katseyu tir'e v'kulolo tir'e v'kuvno li misham. Right from there, you'll be able to curse them. V'yichiyu sedei tsofim el rosh ha-pisgah. So he goes to this place called Sedei Tsofim, or lookout field on top of the cliff. Sedei Tsofim el rosh ha-pisgah. So they try again, and so on. And again, over here, by the way, it's V'yikar Hashem el Bilam. Over here, it's Yudke Vovke speaks, but there may not have been any idolatry over here. Whatever this state Sofim is, it may have been different. But again, he's not allowed to curse the people, and they're going to try one more time. Pasuk of Zayin, V'yom Balak el Bilam l'cha na ekcha el makom acher. Let's try another place. Ula yasher b'enei ha'elokim, which is also another shift in terms of the names. V'kodoli misham. V'yikach Balak Bilam, where? Rosh ha'pa'or. So is anybody here going to say, oh, what a coincidence that place is called Pa'or? Or do you think we may be onto something over here, that actually the names which were being used are really quite significant? So it's interesting that the first time they tried from a place from the power of Baal, and the third place from the power of Pa'or, and the middle place was one that I did not necessarily understand. That's your homework. What this middle place was in terms of, was there also some kind of idolatrous power? Or maybe not. Maybe that's not working. Let's try something else. But of course, what I'm saying is you're dealing with polytheists. When you deal with polytheists, we can try all kinds of things because something may work. But when you realize that two of the three places that they used in order to view the people to curse them from are called Baal and Pa'or, then I think that we have a little bit of insight and hopefully understanding. In source number 9, the Midrash says, by both of these places, Baal and Pa'or, the Midrash, by Pa'or said, by Baal said, by Baal, b'mot Baal, Balak haya Baal ksamim, right? Balak himself was somebody who had his affinity and powers in terms of ksamim, v'nachashim yoter mi Bilam, which is interesting. He was actually more adept at the occult than Bilam was, and therefore he was trying to manipulate this by the virtual places. Shaya Bilam Holech Acharav Kisuma, and Bilam was actually manipulated and brought. V'shaya Balak Ro'eh Atidot Shisroyu Atidim L'chtob Baal Pa'or K'dei Shiyizkor Lahem HaKodesh Baruch Hu Oto Avon V'gam Yiniach Lahem L'Klalam. He knew the Jews were going to someday fall to Baal Pa'or, so that's why he felt he can use Baal, and then he tried Pa'or, because again, he sees things but without clarity, which is a really interesting point of the Midrash, that eventually they're going to sin in this area, and he says the same thing, the Midrash says by Perik Kuf Gimel Simon Kuf Chet, V'yikach Balak Bilam Rosh HaPa'or, and he says the exact same commentary, because he knew that it was going to be either Baal or Pa'or, or Baal Pa'or, and in the end, they go after them with both. What I find remarkable is source number 11 is the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Chanina b'Shvil Arbim v'Shtayim Korbanot. That's the total number that he brought. Yeah, 42 Korbanot is the amount that Balak brought. Barak Melech Barav Huvku'u Yisrael Arbim v'Shnayim Yiladim. Those are the 42 children who were making fun of Elisha, if you remember that. He goes, they ended up dying because of those 42 Korbanot, which is, again, such a strange comment. A person should serve God even without the proper intention. And it's saying that he served God lolishma, and lolishma, by the way, is balishma. I don't see where, by the way, all the commentaries are troubled by this. They're troubled by it with which there's no. His lo lishma here is in order to eradicate the Jews. I mean, as sick as it may be, it's like Hitler saying to Hillel to be successful with his crematoria. I mean, it's like What are you talking about? I mean, this Gemara is, and on top of all that, I am totally unconvinced that the various korbanot that he brings were actually dedicated to God when you're bringing them from the Pa'or background or you bring them from the Baal background. So what are you talking about? And say, no, but because of this, he ended up having the merit that one day Ruth was going to come from him and from him Shlomo was going to come from her, and eventually we're going to have the Beit HaMikdash and all those korbanot, which are going to end up being brought from Shlomo and extension from Shlomo, which is just an unbelievable statement, which means that if somebody did a gesture which in some way may have resembled a positive thing, because again, I don't even know how far to go by saying he, because of the korbanot that he brought. The Gemara seems to be implying that the korbanot that he brought were really L'shem Shemayim, but L'shem Shemayim to get rid of the Jews, and even I'm not convinced that they were ever L'shem Shemayim because of all of the idolatrous background, which is why, again, I think that this is just absolutely bizarre. Correct. Which again, is this polytheism in its perfect sense. Yeah. Why? Because the number 42 is in both. Other than that, I have not succeeded in figuring out what else is going on over there. But I think if one works harder, one will find something. But I did not locate it yet. It was simply the number 42 are by both. Okay. In source 15, the Or HaChaim, who is channeling the Talmudic tradition, that Pa'or itself, he says, V'yaduhi ki Pa'or avodato hi hatrazat zevel b'fanav. Again, to defecate in front of the idol. Now, this may be an exaggeration. As I said before, it may be a caricature. But we should still pay attention to the core message. The core message is one that all parts of nature have some kind of holiness to it. Which means I would be very tempted to bring this towards much more of a pantheism. Those of you who still remember the 60s, and when we still suffer from this today, that if something's natural, therefore it's good for you. There are a lot of natural things that are very, very bad for you. There's some natural things that are not bad for you, but you think are bad for you, but like schmaltz. But there are natural things that could kill you. And, you know, things could just have to say in the ingredients, 100% natural, okay, that's good. No. Not everything which is 100% natural is is good. So we still suffer from this worship of nature, as it were, and that may have been the background and really what Chazal were exaggerating with, oh, that's a natural bodily function, so therefore that's how you serve the idol. But as I said, there may be a caricature involved in this. See, this also what leads you towards the open sexual behavior which is taking place. It's basically a natural phenomenon, a natural behavior, and therefore this is holy. And you therefore could say, and again, I want to be careful, because, and this is what, if you read the Netziv, and he talks about this in a dozen different places, to what extent, when the girls went down, was that a practice of Pa'or? To what extent was that Kamush? To what extent was that just something else? But you also realize something else now. Pa'or was a very dangerous idolatry. It was dangerous because it was telling you to do things that are natural, and it's saying that that nature is basically has holiness to it. And if I take this Gemara even somewhat seriously, somebody, okay, you have the seduction taking place, and all that you have to do is to worship this idol, but you can worship this idol by urinating in front of the idol. So if you're a Jewish man, and you say, that's all that I have to do? And he's saying to himself, I don't believe in this idol at all. You know, I'm doing something, as far as I'm concerned, which is completely disgusting to this idol. I'm making fun of the idol. And at the same time, you're actually worshiping it. Which is actually, if I go back, you know, the Pesel Micha, there was like this disconnect between the actual doing it versus believing in it. And over here, you have the doing it but not believing in it. But the terrible thing about Pa'or is that you didn't have to believe in it when you're doing it, because that's actually the message itself. And I know that was confusing, so I'll say it again. It was, if it was a worship of nature, so therefore all kinds of bodily functions are involved in this. And before you know it, you're involved in the service of Pa'or. And as far as you're concerned, you did not do anything. And the commentaries speak of Pa'or, therefore, as being a particularly seductive type of an idolatry. The mentioning of Shlomo before was actually more painful than I let on when I read it. Because what did the Gemara say? The Gemara said, oh, because Balak, look what happened. Ruth ended up coming back. Again, Ruth from Moab ends up coming back. And then we end up having Shlomo. Look at verse 18. Again, Sefer Melachim, Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph. Vayelech Shlomo acharei Ashtarot Elohei Tzidonim. And Shlomo ended up worshipping the Ashtarot, which was the Tzidonim god. Vacharei Milcom Sheketz Amonim. And he worshipped Milcom. Milcom is connected to Molach. That should be very interesting to us, because that was the god of Ammon. Who's Ammon? Who is Ammon? Good. Lot's other son, Ammon. And now that's really interesting. Anybody remember what Molach is? How you serve Molach? Yeah. Now, why would that family have some kind of a connection with that kind of service? Who was Lot's father? Lot's grandfather. Who was his father? And what happened to Haran? What did Terach try to do to Avram to throw him into the furnace? Is it an interesting that the god of Ammon would therefore be Molach? I mean, that, again, you go back to history there, and then you see something really interesting. Vayas Shlomo hara b'nei Hashem v'lo milach harei Hashem k'David aviv. Az yivne Shlomo bama l'kamush. Oh, there you go. You should have known about Kamush. It was one of Shlomo's many gods. Shiketz Moav. He served the god of Moav, which well, here you're told black and white, which is Kamush. V'har eshel p'nei Yerushalayim. U'lemolach shukatz b'nei Amon. And he served Molach as well. So essentially, Shlomo, you thought he had a lot of wives. V'chein asah l'kol nashav anachriyot. He made each one of his wives happy. Oh, you like this god? Okay, we'll serve this god. You like this god? We'll serve this god. Very multicultural. Right? This is very in. Maktirodim is v'chot le'elohehin. V'yit anaf Hashem b'shlomo ki natal levavo mi'im Hashem l'kei Yisrael n'ir'a elav pa'amayim. God had appeared to him. Nonetheless, look how he behaves. But what I really find interesting about the whole story of Shlomo, which again, we have the starting point, Shlomo, Ruth, going back to Moab, Balak bringing his offerings. Can you imagine being Balak then? You invested your money, you bring these offerings to get rid of the Jews, and you're told afterwards, okay, the offer, we have good news and bad news. Good news is God accepted the offerings. Bad news is he's not listening to you. Good news is that your descendants will build a Beit. The Jews are going to the land of Israel. They're going to capture it all. They're going to build a Beit HaMikdash. Your great-granddaughter is going to be the queen of all of the Jews, or the, shall we say, the queen mother, as it were, queen grandmother, as it were. And eventually you're going to build a Beit HaMikdash. By the way, you will have some success because the one who builds the Beit HaMikdash now is going to come back and is actually going to be seduced by all these wives that he's end up having and end up worshipping all the idols, which means Shlomo bringing all of these offerings, there's two sides to that coin. He brings all these offerings to God, but he also ends up serving all of these other gods, not in a dissimilar way to his, I hate to say it, his great-great-grandfather, Balak, who's bringing all these offerings right there. And therefore, even the section at the end where the girls go down and bring the Jews towards idolatry, look how all of this is there in the background as well. And therefore, the whole story of Shlomo over here is so much more interesting than I think that we ever realized before, because we never connected the story of Shlomo back to Ruth, back to Balak, to the offerings of Balak, and now the offerings of Shlomo. But listen, we like to believe that by the end of days, by the end of his time, Shlomo ended up coming back. But again, this little snapshot of Shlomo is telling you really the bad things that he did. And again, it's this interrelationship between his wives, his relationships, and his idolatry that he did. I do want to end up with one last thing for today. I don't know how much time we have. As soon as Rabbi Taub sticks his head in, we stop, because I told him I will try to stop on time. Moshe is eventually buried by Peor. And Moshe serves as this antidote to Peor. So that itself is apparently very important. Moshe's grave is described as being created on Friday, during the 6 days of creation, already the grave was ready, which means when all of nature comes into the world, the grave of Moshe, which will be the spirituality, which will fight against this idolatrous, cultish worship of nature, is already there as well. The The other thing is that no one knows where Moshe's buried. Moshe's, in fact, there's a beautiful passage in Chazal that say that from above it looks like it's below, from below it looks like it's above, and that it's really not connected to this world or the other world. It's connected to both, but it's someplace in between. And the last thing I wanted to say about that is we all know that we don't know where Moshe's buried, right? That we know. It says even Moshe didn't know where Moshe's buried because Moshe, nobody knows where he's buried. So even Moshe didn't know where he's buried exactly. And we know the teaching that sounds like the reason we don't know is because we're afraid that they were going to turn that place into an idolatrous place. And therefore, but it was an idolatrous place because he's buried right outside of, we know where he's buried. He's facing Par. So it is an idolatrous place. So it's very interesting to realize now that wherever he went up to that mountain with these bamot, that may be very, very close to where Moshe is buried, and that's the description. But the Maharal has a little bit of a twist on this. The Maharal says that we don't know, and you have the source here. It's source number 21. He says the reason we don't know where Moshe is buried is because every prayer would come true from that grave. You know, people go to Kivrei Tzadikim. He says the problem with Moshe's grave is that it's too powerful. It's too powerful. See, that's what was interesting over here, is that even the prayers or the actions of Balak will have some kind of impact in the world. Again, some good and some bad. Building the Beit HaMikdash, thousands of korbanot, but maybe there was some bad impact there as well. Can you imagine praying in front of the antithesis to Pa'or? And that's the grave of Moshe. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. That's this person who is able to, again, be completely outside of that realm of doubt. Total Moshe Emet v'Torah Toh Emet. The Maharal says over here, where it's underlined towards the end, "Umashama b'somach ki lekach lo noda kivrosh shel Moshe shelo yavo litpalel al kivrosh shel Moshe v'yivadlu hagzerah," because it would work if you davened by Moshe's grave. So I think that's the really scary thing. If you really had the ability to say a prayer and it would work, you realize how scary that is? You realize how scary that is? People pray for all kinds of things that, did they really think about the long-term implications of this? So really the story of this whole parsha was one of memory on the one part, going all the way back in history to where things came from and being obsessed with history and not realizing where things are going and what the impact of the behaviors are all the way down the line. And to think about maybe even Moshe's great-grandchildren, that they were disconnected from Moshe and they ended up becoming involved in idolatry and Shlomo was involved in idolatry, which really leads us to one conclusion, is that the power of idolatry was one which we completely don't understand, but that was such a part of that fabric of that life. And what this whole background is learning how to have the antidote to that. And Rabbi Taub walked in. So Shabbat Shalom.